I'm Tracy Sable. Tonight on EWTN News Nightly, Path to Sainthood. The Vatican makes a major announcement about Blessed Carlo Acutis, the millennial who loved computers and the Eucharist. Official state visit. The Biden administration welcomes the president of Kenya on a milestone anniversary for the two nations. We're at the White House. Rising tension. Taiwan's new president is met with an immediate test from China. We have analysis from Gordon Chang. And global gathering. Church leaders from around the world are in Rome for an award named for St. John Paul II. These stories and more tonight.
From EWTN, the Global Catholic Network, this is EWTN News Nightly.
Thank you for being with us. Our top story tonight, President Joe Biden welcomes Kenyan President William Ruto to the White House, the first state visit to the United States by an African leader in more than 15 years. On the South Lawn, President Biden emphasized the partnership between both nations, saying we are stronger and the world is safer when Kenya and the United States work together. White House correspondent Owen Jensen reports. Owen.
Tracy, President Joe Biden also said in his remarks today that the U.S. and Kenya stand together and are committed to each other and are committed to building a better world. And the visit aimed at recognizing the growing importance of the U.S.-Kenya relationship and to convince African nations the U.S. is a better partner than economic rival China.
Under cloudy, rainy skies and a patriotic and pomp-filled ceremony on the White House South Lawn, the two leaders reveal the assembled respective military branches. Moments later, President Joe Biden steps to the podium.
It's an honor to welcome you to the White House to celebrate 60 years of partnership between Kenya and the United States.
And that partnership includes...
Across the region, Kenya and America are driving a race to the top with investments that we have and high standards for workers, technology, and environment.
But one major concern, money. Kenya is most indebted to China.
And we're working to ensure debt doesn't leave these critical investments and crucial investments out of reach for low and middle-income countries.
And President William Ruto, whose country is struggling with a high cost of living, discussed what he called the opportunity for access to markets.
So that we can create more jobs, we can create more wealth, and we can spread prosperity across our continent.
Later at a news conference in the East Room, President Biden with this NATO-related announcement.
We're working with Congress to designate Kenya a major non-NATO ally.
That announcement, an acknowledgement of the growing security partnership between the two countries. The Nairobi government is sending police to Haiti to help quell gang violence in the Caribbean nation. The 1,000 Kenyan officers preparing to deploy will be part of a multinational force backed by $300 million in U.S. support, but not American troops. Haiti is also facing the highest number of malnourished children ever, according to the country's health ministry.
Now, the Biden administration has praised Kenya for stepping up in Haiti, the Western Hemisphere's poorest nation, and Pope Francis praying for Haiti. Recently said the population there is in despair because of the collapse of the healthcare system, food shortages, and violence, adding Haiti badly needs peace and stability. At the White House, Owen Jensen, EWTN News Nightly.
A strong punishment. That is how China is characterizing its military exercises around Taiwan. It comes just 3 days after the country's newly elected president made a controversial inauguration speech where he vowed to keep Taiwan's democracy safe.
I want to call on China to cease their political and military intimidation against Taiwan. Share with Taiwan the global responsibility of maintaining peace and stability in the Taiwan Strait, as well as the greater region, and ensure the world is free from the fear of war.
On the sea and air, exercises encircled Taiwan. China's military said that it was meant as a stern warning to its opponents seeking independence. China claims self-governed Taiwan as part of its national territory. Gordon Chang, author of The Coming Collapse of China and The Great U.S.-China Tech War, joins us now to talk more about China's provocations. Gordon, welcome back. Always so good to see you. So what more can you tell us about today's events?
Well, the Chinese exercises, this joint sword, actually not only encircled the main island of Taiwan, but also the outlying islands, which are very close to the Chinese mainland. And really what this is a warning that China will impose an embargo. Now, it didn't really matter what William Lai said at his inauguration on Monday. The Chinese had planned this a long time, but clearly William Lai is willing to say, look, we want to talk to China, we want to maintain the status quo, but really China is not listening.
And Gordon, is there anything else that really stands out to you about today's activity, anything particularly concerning?
Well, what concerns me most is sort of a bigger picture, that Xi Jinping is not afraid of the United States, and that because of a basically feeble Biden policy, he sees an historic opportunity to make gains. You got to remember that President Trump in December 2016, before he took office, actually accepted a phone call from Lai's predecessor, Tsai Ing-wen. And that told the Chinese that Trump was not afraid of China. That had peace on the agenda for 4 years. I think that President Biden needs to call Lai himself and show the Chinese that he, too, is not afraid.
Gordon, from a strategic standpoint, why would China perform these exercises, you know, out in the open for Taiwan to see and possibly study?
Well, I think that China is trying to intimidate the Taiwan population. Now, that hasn't worked for a very long time because the Taiwanese have sort of become accustomed to these provocative Chinese military maneuvers, but also its stiffened resolve on the island. Got to remember that Lai is historic in the sense that this is the first time in Taiwan's democracy that the Taiwan people have elected in three straight presidential elections a person from the same party. That's the Democratic Progressive Party, which is, quote unquote, pro-independence.
And we heard from the head of the Indo-Pacific Command, but what exactly is being done maybe to prevent these exercises from turning into a real invasion?
Well, right now, the U.S. is pretty quiet about this. That's been sort of settled U.S. policy. But I think we need to be less ambiguous. We need to tell China that we are willing to defend Taiwan should China invade. If we do that, I think the Chinese back off.
Gordon, almost out of time, but quickly, what other stories are you following right now?
The biggest flashpoint in East Asia is really not Taiwan, but is the South China Sea at Scarborough Shoal, Second Thomas Shoal, where the Chinese are engaging in some very, very dangerous and provocative acts, despite warnings from the Biden administration, which showing that deterrence has broken down.
Well, Gordon, thank you so much for being with us and always appreciate your analysis.
Thank you, Tracy.
Day one of the United Kingdom's general campaigns kicked off today. Voters, media, and much of the Prime Minister's own party are still reeling from Rishi Sunak's surprise announcement about the elections.
Now is the moment for Britain to choose its future, to decide whether we want to build on the progress we have made or risk going back to square one with no plan and no certainty. Earlier today, I spoke with His Majesty the King to request the dissolution of Parliament. The King has granted this request, and we will have a general election on the 4th of July.
All right, to discuss this, let's go to London-based correspondent Paul Hawkins. Paul, good to be with you today. There was speculation that a vote would take place this fall, so why the vote now?
One word, inflation. Inflation in the UK. Figures were released yesterday and it showed inflation in the UK falling to 2.3%. Now, the Bank of England's target is 2%. And finally, it gave Rishi Sunak a little bit of economic good news that he could then go to the British people. Now, those figures were only for one quarter. And so that's why a lot of people were surprised. I mean, we woke up yesterday morning thinking, OK, yeah, good inflation down to 2.3%. It was at 10%, and inflation in the UK has been falling at a slower rate than in the rest of the world, especially over in the US. So it's been a big problem here, and it's affected the cost of living for a lot of Britons. So lots of people were surprised when all of a sudden, come the afternoon, and even members of his own government didn't know about this. They had a meeting, a cabinet meeting was called. They were even given a fake agenda at that meeting, ahead of that meeting. And then when they sat down, he said, guys, I'm going to call an election. And the big reason was this 2.3% inflation figure, which means that the cost of living is coming down. And he's now presenting that to the public as signs that his economic plan is working, because the UK economy, and this is going to be the big election issue, the UK economy is in dire straits. Growth at best is anemic at the moment, much, much, much slower than, for comparison, the US, for example. Even since the pandemic, growth rates of just below 2%, whereas we know that the US economy has been steaming ahead at the moment. So a little bit of good news surprised everyone. He's decided to take that to the public and call that general election, which we all thought was going to happen later in the year. Lots of his own MPs were thinking, look, let's just get a few more months under our belt, get a little bit more good news under our belt, a few more good economic indicators, and then we can go to the British public and try and sell it to them. And we need all the good news we can get because, of course, Rishi Sunak's Conservative Party are way behind in the opinion polls and have been for a year.
Paul, we only have maybe a minute or so left, but quickly, what can you tell us about the Prime Minister's opponent?
So Keir Starmer, Labour leader, he is and was a lawyer, a director of public prosecutions here in the UK. He's a football fan. He took over as leader of the Labour Party after that huge election defeat for Labour in 2019, has moved the party away from the left, away from nationalising lots of key British industries, more towards the centre ground. Think of it as a bit more like Tony Blair in where he's positioning the Labour Party more towards the centre ground. But crucially, he doesn't have that charisma that Tony Blair has. A congenial guy, a nice guy, and someone who is way ahead in the opinion polls. And his strong election message will be changed. That after 14 years of a Conservative government, the country needs change. And now he needs to go and sell that to the British public.
Paul, 20 seconds left and a whole lot of time. But for those of us in the U.S. and other parts of the world, what is the biggest concern, or one of the bigger concerns for those in the U.K. right now?
Definitely the economy. As I said, economic growth is really, really slow in the UK, where taxes are high. Government borrowing is really high, so you can't raise taxes, you can't borrow any more money. And so everyone is saying the only way to raise more money to fund public services which need that investment is through economic growth. And so that will be the big message. That will be the big message that both parties will try to sell to the electorate, how we are going to grow the economy.
And Paul, thank you for your time and your analysis today. We appreciate it. Well, at least 9 people are dead and more than 100 others injured after a stage collapse during a political rally in Mexico. A strong gust of wind is said to have caused the tragedy during an event for presidential candidate Jorge Alvarez Maynez. He escaped without injury and has promised a full investigation. The elections are set to take place June 2nd. Well, it is official. Florida Senator Rick Scott joined the race to be the Senate's next Republican leader. In a letter to colleagues, Scott said the next leader should be limited to a 6-year term. He also called for following a realistic schedule for bills to go through committee. He joins South Dakota Senator John Thune, currently the number 2 Senate Republican, and Texas Senator John Cornyn in the race for leader. Senate Republicans usually hold leadership elections in November after the general election. Despite previously calling him unhinged, diminished, and not qualified to be the president of the United States, former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley says that she will vote for Donald Trump in the general election. Haley also says that she is encouraging the presumptive GOP nominee to work hard to win support for those who backed her in the primary. Haley's campaign for president ended around 2 months ago. No reaction yet from the Trump campaign on Haley's big announcement. After years of complaints over high prices and add-on fees for concerts and sporting events, the Department of Justice has filed a sweeping antitrust lawsuit against Ticketmaster and its parent company, Live Nation.
Our complaint makes clear what happens when a monopolist dedicates its resources to entrenching its monopoly power and insulating itself from competition rather than investing in better products and services. We allege that Live Nation has illegally monopolized markets across the live concert industry in the United States for far too long. It is time to break it up.
Lawmakers in Louisiana approve a measure to classify abortion pills as a controlled dangerous substance. The measure now heads to the desk of Republican Governor Jeff Landry, who has said he supports it. The first of its kind bill would reclassify mifepristone, a misoprostol, which could make it harder to gain access to them. A graduation gift of sorts for college and trade school graduates. The Biden administration is canceling some $7.7 billion in student loans for more than 160,000 borrowers. President Biden says that it is part of an ongoing effort to provide relief after the Supreme Court blocked his plan last year for broad-based college loan forgiveness. Capitol Hill correspondent Eric Rosales joins us now with more. Eric?
Good evening, Tracy. The overall numbers are eye-popping. With the latest action, the administration has canceled $167 billion in student debt for nearly 5 million Americans. Republican Senator Bill Cassidy and 30 other GOP lawmakers wrote the education secretary demanding the latest initiative be pulled.
They call it forgiveness. I call it a scheme. The Biden administration isn't forgiving student loans. They're transferring the student loan debt from those who took it on to get an education to make more money to those who either never went to college or paid it back.
So who is benefiting? Education Secretary Miguel Cardona posted in a statement, quote, "We remain persistent in fixing a broken student loan system. 1 in 10 federal student loan borrowers have now received forgiveness, meaning these borrowers now have financial breathing room and a burden lifted. And we're not done yet." Democrats praise the latest effort.
Well, I mean, if you can bail out, you know, banks, I mean, I feel like helping out students to get a better start in their lives, then I think that's a much better investment than a bunch of reckless banks.
I think that black folk need to know that this administration has actually invested in them. When you start looking at student debt relief, it has disproportionately positively impacted black folk. We're talking about over $137 billion for over 4 million people.
Republicans accuse the Biden administration of breaking the law and blame universities for rising education costs. Senator Joni Ernst, a veteran, tells me Biden's plan will affect military recruitment as well.
They knew not only would they be serving their country, but they would receive benefits like the GI Bill, ways to pay for college education. Now, they have said to me, why on earth did I serve overseas in horrible conditions when I could have gotten it for free?
Bottom line,
this is, I think, vote buying in front of an election in which he thinks he's going to lose, and so therefore he's got to use our federal treasury to buy those votes.
Conservatives are already planning lawsuits to challenge the plan, calling it an unfair bonus for wealthy college graduates at the expense of taxpayers who didn't attend college who already paid their loans. At the Capitol, Eric Rosales, EWTN News Nightly.
And we have a lot more still to come here on EWTN News Nightly, including Capitol grilling. University leaders answer tough questions regarding possible anti-Semitism on campus. And why an advocate for religious freedom is refusing to attend her reunion at an Ivy League school. Students of UCLA, Rutgers, and Northwestern universities face highly charged questions from lawmakers on Capitol Hill today. Specifically, the House Committee on Education and the Workforce grilled the educators on claims of anti-Semitism on campus.
The benefit of hindsight, we should have been prepared to immediately remove the encampment if and when the safety of our community was put at risk.
The fact that we didn't have not yet suspended or expelled students does not mean that students have not received discipline. There's a wide range of discipline, and discipline has been meted out to many of those students.
Rutgers and Northwestern face criticism for offering concessions to the demonstrators in exchange for the voluntary removal of tents. Those agreements also included avoiding possible violence and disruptions at graduation ceremonies. However, several Jewish students have taken matters into their own hands, bringing lawsuits against the schools. Meantime, while Rutgers and Northwestern try to make efforts to avoid disruptions during their college graduation ceremonies, other universities had to contend with pro-Palestinian and anti-Israel protests during what is supposed to be a joyous occasion for graduates. There were small but vocal demonstrations earlier this month at Cal Berkeley's graduation and in the nation's capital, George Washington University's commencement also featured protests. It's something that has caused a Yale alum to stage a protest of a different kind. To tell us more about that, let's bring in Katrina Lanto-Sweat, president of the Lantos Foundation. Katrina, welcome back. Good to have you on again. You recently wrote an op-ed in Real Clear Politics entitled, Why I'm Skipping My 50th Yale Reunion. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, well, like many alumni, I was really looking forward to what is obviously a very notable milestone. But I felt as I watched the explosion of anti-Semitism on Yale's campus, obviously echoed on dozens and dozens of campuses around the country, that I couldn't simply shrug my shoulders and go and have a good time with my friends from those bright college years, but that I really needed to speak out about a culture that has been coddled and nurtured and normalized on so many of our great college campuses and other institutions, a culture that is tolerant of and shrugs its shoulders at really horrifying anti-Semitism.
Yeah, and I know that you place some of this type of culture on college campuses, at least in part, on school administrators and the leadership there. Talk to us more about that.
Yeah, well, you know, students are going to be and do what they want to be and do, but we look to the leadership of a university or any institution to set a moral tone and to demonstrate some moral courage. And I think that that's been sadly absent. I really do. You know, in my op-ed, I say, where are the ringing and unequivocal denunciations of this anti-Semitism and virulent anti-Zionism on the part of, you know, presidents of universities? Why haven't we seen the president of Yale University or other such institutions walking in solidarity with their Jewish students and showing that kind of moral courage? So, you know, obviously the initial responsibility lies with the students and the professors and others engaging in what I consider to be deeply anti-Semitic protests. But you know, you have to follow it a little further upstream. And I think that, as I say, a culture has been encouraged and nurtured and tolerated. And now we're kind of reaping that whirlwind.
Yeah. And Katrina, I mean, I know you've talked a lot about anti-Semitism, the rise in it since October 7th, you know, here in the United States and around the world. Yeah. But did you ever think that you would see this, you know, in institutions of higher learning like your alma mater, Yale?
No, I didn't. You know, I myself am the daughter of two Holocaust survivors, so I'm very passionate and sensitive around these issues. And I was beginning, of course, to sense how greatly the culture had changed. I'm an adjunct professor at Tufts University, and I've noticed in recent years that sometimes after class, my Jewish students would come to me privately and individually and say, you know, your class feels a little bit like an island of safety and sanity in what is a very hostile environment. And so somehow academia has become a very toxic environment for people who are of Jewish heritage, people who strongly support the survival and the thriving of the only Jewish homeland in the world. And, you know, my family experienced personally what it meant when Jews globally sort of were thrown on the mercy of others in the Holocaust, and that mercy did not extend to them. And we know what the results of that were. And so this is so troubling to me and so heartbreaking. But I think we have to find our own backbone and our own moral courage to stand up and say, this is not acceptable. And for me, that meant a very small sacrifice in terms of giving up an event I had looked forward to for many years, but also speaking out. And I have been heartened by the number of fellow classmates who have reached out to me to say, you've expressed what I've been feeling. A lot of them said they also won't be going, and others said they were going, but they agreed with me and intended to try and raise these issues.
And Katrina, thank you so much for speaking to us about all this. We appreciate it. God bless you.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Up next on EWTN News Nightly, Path to Sainthood, a major announcement from the Vatican regarding Blessed Carlo Acutis. Church leaders from around the world, especially in Poland, gathered last night in Rome. They were there to present the inaugural award named for St. John Paul II.
Della prima edizione del premio Giovanni Paolo II.
The prize was given to the John Paul II Justice and Peace Center in Uganda. The center says it's inspired by the Polish Pope and works to spread the saint's social teaching to the people of Africa. Several of the church leaders also met with Pope Francis. So finally tonight, big news regarding a Catholic figure who's especially popular among young people, as Pope Francis recognizes a miracle attributed to Blessed Carlo Acutis. In an earlier interview, his mother told EWTN about her son's faith journey.
And he started to go to Mass each day, to do Eucharistic adoration each day, the daily prayer of the Rosary, and also the Bible, because he liked to. For Carlo, the Bible was like a compass.
The Holy Father approved the miraculous healing of a 21-year-old girl from Costa Rica who was near death after seriously injuring her head in a bicycle accident. The recognition of the second miracle attributed to Carlo's intercession makes it possible that he could be canonized during the Catholic Church's 2025 Jubilee year. Blessed Carlo became well known for starting a website detailing Eucharistic miracles. He grew up in Italy, where he loved soccer, computers, and Holy Communion. Blessed Carlo Acutis died of cancer in 2006. He was just 15 years old. And we thank you for watching tonight. Remember, you can follow us on social media, Facebook, X, and Instagram at EWTN News Nightly. I'm Tracy Sable, and we leave you more with scenes from the life of Blessed Carlo Acutis. Good night, and God bless.